Right, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. We are York Hospital Radio. We provide a service for people in York Hospital. And York Hospital Radio is 60 years old on Friday, so that's pretty good going for a charity. So, yeah, our first guest tonight is a former York City player and Huddersfield Town cult hero turned radio pundit. Owen was the optimist, the only man who thought a comeback was on at Nantwich. He's also York City's hospitality host. Tonight we are doing a football quiz, and undoubtedly many others have had the question of who scored the first ever golden goal in football. That honour is firmly with our guest tonight, Mr. Ian Dunn. So I thought we'd start with your early playing career at Boothen Crescent. Bobby Saxton, I think, signed you.
He did, right? Yes, yeah. In 88.
88. Sad time for the club, really, Bobby Saxton, wasn't it?
It was a terrible time, yeah. Particularly thanks, good. Dan, for bringing that up.
Yeah. Given you were a supporter growing up, what was the feeling like signing for the club?
I was a kid, from the age of 6 or 7, I used to go and watch York City. So I was brought up with disappointment, really, from 70, I think I saw 3 re-elections in my youth, hence supporting Liverpool as well. I needed some sort of positivity in my life. I supported City all my life. I was just, as everyone probably in this room, it was where you went on a Saturday afternoon, sometimes if you're lucky, Tuesday nights. And I played youth team football in and around York most of my youth career.
Yeah, and ball boy as well a few times, I think.
I was ball boy the season we went up. So I had literally 90% of the games. Do you remember Colin Sanderson? You remember Colin Sanderson? I think I was the apple in his eye, to be honest. We used to go and do junior reds and play football in the gym on a Thursday night. And the ball boys rotated in them days, so they'd rotate them every week. But I got every game, so I was quite fortunate.
Very good. Very good. And you scored in your home debut versus Doncaster?
I did,
What
yes.
Do you remember about that game?
Well, as David Ward will testify, I don't remember what I had for dinner yesterday, so I struggle. I actually came on against Grimsby the week before, I think, and I did okay. And then, I think, did Dale Banton get sold?
Yes, I think he did.
And
yeah.
I was sort of like, John Bird told me that he'd sold Dale Banton because he thought he had a replacement, and that was me. So I think that was him just trying to build me up a bit. And then I played that night, scored on my debut, yeah. In fact, I scored 3 in my first 5.
Very good.
And then John Bird tried to convert me to a midfielder.
Speaking of John Bird, that was my next question, because this was slightly before my time, so I started going when John Ward took over, and I guess you could call me a glory spotter back then. But
you were brought up with a bit of success.
Yeah, I was, yeah. Hoodwinked. But John Bird, when I look back at all the people that I've interviewed who played under him, they always talk about this shot of whiskey that he used to give the players before they all came out.
Yeah.
And I wondered, were they so bad because you were all pissed when you went out on the pitch?
Well, I think the only reason he did it because he was pissed before the game. So he needed all the rest of us to be the same state. Yeah, he did that. As a youngster, you just follow the trend. And, you know, if you didn't do it, you'd get mocked by the rest of the lads. So, yeah, he did that. And, yeah, he stunk a whiskey for... That's probably why we were crap. But, we had John Bird, he was a funny guy. The weird thing is with John Bird, if you look at the players he signed... He actually left some really good players for John Ward.
Yeah.
That team.
Yeah. John McCarthy, I think.
He signed Dean Kiley, John McCarthy, Jinnah, Ray Warburton. I'm going to say Halliwell. I thought that was Bobby Saxon, wasn't it? But he signed some good players, and they all went on and had their own individual success. Pepper. Signed Pepper as well.
Yeah.
So...
I don't normally listen back to interviews, but I've made an exception this week and listened back to our interview we did a few years ago. And something I'd missed off at the time was you spoke really eloquently and emotionally about the tragedy of David Longhurst, and you guys were pretty close. But you also mentioned you both signed up to a French course at York Tech. And I didn't really pick up on it at the time, and we didn't sort of delve into that. So tell us about that. Were you
playing league? I know you always say about people, don't you, when you know the best people go. But Longy genuinely was just like a normal lad, really nice lad. He'd come from, I think, Forest, Halifax, wherever we signed him from, but he was brought up the right way, so he could play football. He was a good player. And but off the field, he was just really integrated himself with the lads straight away. And I just got on with him. I don't know, I was a young lad. Maybe he was looking out for me, I don't know. I was a young lad. He sort of took me under his wing a little bit, even though he came after me. He just got on. And at the time, the PFA were trying to educate players to go out and do something other than just football. And we joked, I think, one day, said, hey, just do something, go to the tech and choose a course. And I thought, well, I'm not really good at anything, but I was half decent at French at school, weirdly. That's the one thing I could get away with. And so we signed up for a French course. I remember going to the induction, load of people looking at us, thinking, what the hell are they doing? And there we are, ready signed up for
bon
a French
Joe,
course. Sadly, we never actually got to.
And I
couldn't go in after that. So
yeah, of course, understandably so. Do you regret sort of getting released when you did? I know John Byrne released you, and then obviously John Ward came in, and even had a success.
Regret? It wasn't my choice.
No.
I was released. That football's brutal. Probably lads in this room will know it. If you're not perceived to be good enough, or a manager doesn't like you, whatever reason, it ends just like that. Just, you know, before you even know it, you're out the door. So yes, I was gutted.
Yeah.
After, I'll tell you a story. Actually, this is a true story. So I kind of felt in my second year, so I'd been 19, 20, that I wasn't really getting many opportunities. I was sort of sub and coming on and doing all right, but my reserve team performances were quite good. I was doing all right. So obviously what you did in them days, you go into the manager, knock on his door, why am I not playing? They'd tell you a load of crap, basically.
Drink this whiskey.
Keep your head up. Yeah, have some more whiskey, yeah. But I went in the January of the year I got released. Can't remember, was it 91? And said to John Byrne, listen, I get the feeling, I'm not really getting much of a look in here. He says, no, you're part of my plan, son, you've got a good future here. We'll sort you out in May, as in new contract. And I was naive, you know. If you didn't have agents in them days, we'd have done something then. He basically was just keeping me. You know,
keeping
I was happy.
Sweet.
I was a York City fan. I'm going to get a new contract. That's all I ever really wanted. And it came to May, of course, and he called me in. I remember it like yesterday. He called me into the office, as you do. All the players go in and get your end of season sort of. They'll talk about how you did, and then you get your new contract or not. And he released me that morning. But it was bittersweet because he said, listen, I just think you need to get out of York. So my brother's got a bar in York, a wine bar. I didn't drink, so it wasn't like I was out getting blathered every weekend. But I did used to enjoy going DJing, in fact. Yeah. It was my passion. That was my thing. I liked being a DJ. And it was my sort of, you know, get away from the stresses of anything. Didn't drink. Just went out and played music on a Saturday night.
And that lad loved it.
But
carry on.
Charlatans play all the time, weren't we, Stone Roses? Yeah. Whoop. Yeah. So I think that got back to him a little. Well, I know it got back to him because Alan Little's wife came in one night and I was DJing. And right. I probably wasn't meant to be that night. Something had happened. Anyway, I got caught out. I wasn't drinking. And you had to be gone by 11, so it wasn't even a late night. The words that stick with me just said, listen, you need to get out of York and grow up. And I think I replied and said, I don't really want to grow up. I'm quite happy playing for York City. But no, he just said, listen, there's already been people asking about you. They know I'm releasing you. So Blackpool, Scunthorpe and Chesterfield have all asked about you already. So
did they want DJ sets or did they want you to play football?
Sorry?
Did they want DJ sets or did they want
I thought it was meant DJing. I'd have gone like a shot. So it was a bittersweet day. And that afternoon, we had to go. It was the end of season due, and Dave McGirt would probably say that the lads go out. We went to the races, and I was in tears. I genuinely, like a young lad, and I just gutted. Everything had gone. I thought that was it, as you do. But no, I got lucky after that.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to Huddersfield. And I was reading this interview you'd done with the Huddersfield Hub. I don't know if you remember doing this interview. And I just was laughing at the intro they'd given you. So it said, John Major was Prime Minister. Oasis were one of the top bands around, and Huddersfield were struggling in Division 2. In the summer, a follically challenged Dunn would arrive at the club and become a cult hero. And then they've done this interview with you.
I don't remember that. I certainly don't remember the introduction, but yeah.
No.
Yeah. I didn't sign in the summer. I signed in the... I trained with them, a child with them, in the October and signed in the November. So I didn't play in the summer, so they got that wrong.
Yeah, well, I'll send you the website where it's off. Yeah, he probably didn't tell you what his intro was going to be. Yeah. But he did play for Neil Warnock and was quite successful in him. What you mentioned about John Byrd there being interesting manager to play for. What was Warnock like to play for? And can you tell us any stories about your time playing under him?
You either like him or hate him, don't you? If you got on with it, if you worked hard for him, he looked after you. I think I probably did hit lucky when I went to Huddersfield because they were just getting the new ground. I signed in the 92. They were struggling. The previous year, they just missed out on the playoffs. And I think there was a bit of a hangover from that. with the players, because all the players are still the same lads. Peter Jackson, Ife Nora, Ewan Roberts, Phil Starbuck, all good. Kieran O'Regan played for Ireland. All good players, but they were struggling. They couldn't get a tune out of them. And yeah, I turned up for training one morning, and I did. I was follicly challenged. I tried to hang on to it a little bit, as you do.
It happens to the best of us.
But they all thought. I found out years later. So I've turned up for training, and because the first team were doing so badly, the manager thought, right, we're going to put a lot of reserve players into the first team for training, and play a practice match. So I ended up playing what was classed as the reserve team, but with Ewan Roberts, Phil Starbuck, Ife Nora, because they had been dropped. And no disrespect to the players I'd been playing with, not, you know, York and Chesterfield, these were on a different level to what I'd been used to playing. They were better footballers, and I found life easier playing with better footballers. It made me a little bit better, if that makes sense. Can't explain it very well, but yeah, I went and scored a hat trick. My first practice match. So it was so weird. And years down the line, the Peter Jackson spoke to, like, they have a laugh now. Boothie introduced me back at Huddersfield. He says, you know, the first day we saw him, we thought he was 33. Where's this bloke come from? I was 21. Jesus Christ. I hit the ground running, literally. It's probably my last, you know, I'm going to sound like X Factor here, but it probably was. I'd been training at Scarborough, that which was fantastic. Can't thank them enough for keeping me fit, but I'd been trialling everywhere. Gone to Hull. I played in the Anglo-Italian Cup for Peterborough against Wolves. Didn't get a contract. And then, literally, in that October, Huddersfield, I won't go into the whole story, but somehow I ended up at Huddersfield training with them and did well. Got lucky.
And Warnock, what was he?
So Warnock came the year after. So we did stay up that season. And then the manager went off to Sunderland, actually, got a good job. Then Warnock came in. We all knew about Warnock, and I don't think anyone was really that sure about him. The lads who made it obvious that he weren't sure about, he got rid of. He didn't, just chopped it off of the kneecaps. The lads that wanted to play for him and work for him, he kept. And he was fantastic. But he did something stupid before a match. The day before a match, we'd go in and we'd have the big table, talk tactics, and then at the end of it, he'd get his, brandy. He'd have a bottle of brandy, 18 glasses, 18 eggs. He'd crack an egg into the glass with your brandy, down in one. Anyone that didn't do it, that was it. They didn't play the next day. That was a threat. We all did it. Pissed up driving home. But yeah. Queer. But yeah, no, he was good. He was brilliant, Warnock.
The only time I ever saw you play for Huddersfield Town was against York City when York won 3-0. And my lasting memory of you is that a firework exploded like about an inch from your face. Can you remember that?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. Could not forget. Yeah. It was one of our fans, actually, that threw it. I don't think it was intended to go near me, but Andy McMillan ducked and I got it in my face. No, it flew right past my head, literally banged right next to my head. And, you know, if a firework goes off into your head, it's quite a shock and you don't know what's going on. But yeah, I think you got a good kick in that, lad, to be fair.
Yeah. On Radio York, you are definitely seen as the glass half full character, I think.
Really?
Compared to Dave over there. And I always say to people, you are one of the most optimistic people I know. And one of my best memories of you is when we lost to Bradford Park Avenue 3-0. Do you remember this a couple of years ago?
Yes.
And I turned to you and you went, what do you think, Dan? And I went, I'm sick of being shit. And you went, I'm sick of being shit. I like that, Dan.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, like, is that your personality sort of, because you're on the radio and you want to give people optimism? I mean, me and Paul do it for Hospital Radio, so we're always a bit like, we don't want to depress people that are already in hospital. Yeah. Are you a little bit like that, or were you always like that through your career as well? Were you always like, if we're 3-0 down at half time, come on lads, we can still do this?
I think sometimes I do try and be over when everything's really negative. There's no point keep banging the drum. That they're not going to get better by you telling them how shit they are. That it just didn't, that I've been in that situation, and some players will rise to it, and they'll, you know, but ultimately, if you're crap, you know, you're not doing well. But I do try and pick the bits that might be the positives. And David picks the bits that might not be. It works really well. But he's fair. He's probably more accurate than me, but I am seeing it from a different angle, which is why I do it
Yeah, well, you're on.
You know, I'm the different set of eyes. I've been in the changing room. I know how hard it. Football's hard. It's a brutal game. Everybody wants your job. Everyone wants to beat you. Most people want to kick you at this level. You know, it's a tough, tough gig. And I just think when sometimes if you're a struggling team, if you keep telling them how bad they're going to believe you. See, yeah. You're almost kind of, I want them to do well, but I'm trying to pick out the bits that are good because everyone else will pick the bad bits out. So, yeah.
And just bringing it up to today, up to date, sort of yesterday at Hartlepool. So I took my girlfriend's dad for his first away game for York City.
What did I wrong?
I don't know. But anyway, I turned to me at the end and I said, what's your analysis? I thought, I'm really interested because he's a neutral. He's a Burton Albion fan, so I thought he's got no, you know, interest in either of them really. And he just went, two shit teams on a really shit pitch. Would you concur with that?
Yeah. We went on at the end of the game and the pitch, it looked nice from... You know, from high above, but when you get on it, it was one of them that you needed sort of six in studs. It wasn't good. But he's right, it is. But they're two teams that are struggling. We are struggling. City are a struggling team. They're not going to suddenly become world beaters between now and the end of the season. Neil Hardley's got one job, and that is to keep him in the division. Yeah. If he goes down, it's a disaster. So he's got to somehow keep the spirits up. And there are positives there. There are. If you look really hard, you'll find some. But. Yeah, he's got a big job on. I think everyone's got to be eyes wide open to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the end of my questions. If anyone has got any other questions, Paul's going to whip round with a roving mic. Just tell us what your name is and what your question is. Surely someone, even if you want to ask him about his DJ set in the 90s, you can do.
Don't be knocking it.
Someone at the back there, Paul.
Oh, there's only one. How high?
Oh, I thought you were going to say there's only one to another. That's what I thought you... That would have been...
You disagree?
You were good. No. Yeah, absolutely. How high? Liam Gallagher song, I have. I like it. Bit guitar-y, but that's John Squire, isn't it? Got an album coming out, I believe. And a tour as well.
I love it. He's played his whole life in football. He's funded it.
Yeah.
What's he think about Britpop? Let's get him. Let's get to the real questions. Anyone got any other questions? Paul?
Hello. Paul. Just firstly, yesterday, well done, David and Ian, for eclipsing Barry Parker's "What Bus Is Going Behind the Goal."
That was me. That was me. I apologise.
There was a ship update from behind one of the stands, so that made me chuckle yesterday. On the lines of your media work, what would you say, or who would you say, has been the angriest person that you and David have had to speak to after a game that York have played?
It was me when we got beat by Bradford Park, haven't you?
That was it. This is shit. Life is shit. It's all shit.
Yeah, good one, Dan.
Yeah. That's a really good question. I'm trying to think. You might be able to help me out here. For angry people. Yeah. But I think I'll have had to been there. That'll be you. Martin Gray? He got angry a couple. He got his head used to go red when he was angry, didn't it? Was it Martin? Not Martin Gray. Was it Martin Gray? The manager got from Darlington, exactly. He got angry. He got angry with you one time. I think you'd asked him a very sensible question and got a very angry answer. South Shields. Oh, yeah, he was getting the sack, wasn't he? We knew before him.
You didn't tell him, did you?
You're not recording this, are you? We knew before him. As he's walking back across the pit, I mean, a terrible game. Yeah, well, that was my first game. I'd only met David probably an hour before the kickoff, and he told me, you know, this is his last game, don't you? And I'm like, Gary Mills? Well, I know it's not going well, but yeah. And then he's walking across and I'm thinking, well, what do I do here? And then your first question is, are you going to survive? And I'm thinking,
he's definitely not.
He's gone. He's already gone. He might be on the bus. But yeah, Gary Mills. And I think he must have had an inkling because he wasn't very happy, was he? Yeah.
Can I just say, Martin Gray as well, I read the other week, he offered to work for free, didn't he, to Dalton?
And that would have been too much.
Still didn't appoint him, thought, nah, fuck it, we'll get Steve Watson in.
Colin Sanderson, I remember him well. I was also a junior red.
Right.
Do you remember them ridiculously tight tracksuits that no one fitted in? Because I couldn't fit in one, and I'm guessing you probably couldn't either.
Well, I do remember that. Do you mean the little ball boy tracksuits?
Yes,
I do remember
them. With the Video Shack on the...
Yeah, and the smelly bibs. Yeah.
So they were the size for probably about a seven-year-old when we were 10 or 11.
Yes,
so
I do remember those.
That, I think, it just keeps you all tight.
You see, I think I had this conversation with you, Rusty, and I didn't know, but when I was ball boy, which was obviously probably a decade later, I think the tracksuits were too big. Paul, do you remember that? I saw him come out like, you know, Tom Hanks at the end of Big, when he comes back and he's got his suit just way too big for him. I just look like that, sort of like trying not to trip up.
You used to run out to the middle and have to wave
to people, didn't you? And I was like there trying to pull them up. And
I think these have been around a few years. Yeah, a few washes, not enough, because they did stink as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
My word.
Same era.
Yeah. That is a very similar era,
Ian, at what point in your football career did you think media is what you want to go into? Some players leave and go into coaching, some do media. When did you think you wanted to do media rather than retiring?
So, as you probably know, I was never a big-name footballer. I was all right at Huddersfield, and, you know, it's big stuff within sort of Huddersfield, but out of there, nothing massive. It's not like I made a decision, go into media. Again, just got lucky. It's sometimes you fall at the right place at the right time. I think Sharon Richards and James wife, there he is, had heard that I'd done something for Radio Leeds for Huddersfield, basically. And I think then the question was, well, he lives in York. Why isn't he doing something in York? You might be able to correct me, David. Maybe you were just giving me unwanted. But I'm pretty sure it happened like that. It's not that I made a decision, I'll go into media. I'd love to have been in that position. Trust me. But I'm normal, very, very normal person working in York. But I didn't go straight into... I managed at a local level, so for Huntington Rovers. In fact, one of my star pupils is down there. Haven't seen him in years, Nathan. Nice to see you. So I went into that. That was my next thing, just go and sort of do something locally. And I didn't think it'd last long. It lasted about 10 years. So really, I missed the whole era of York City. Is whenever Huntington were playing, I could come and watch. Or night games, I'd come and watch with one of my best mates, Matty Ward. He was the biggest City fan. You know Matty?
I think so.
Yeah. So we'd come whenever we could. So it wasn't really a decision until I sort of got the Radio Leeds thing. I won't bore you too much. My first game, Radio Leeds, was down at Southampton at Christmas. And it was brilliant, but Southampton at Christmas is a long journey. It was actually Boxing Day. No, 23rd of December. Anyway, the year later, they asked me to go back and do another game, and I'm thinking, is this going to be Southampton again? It's a long journey. Old Trafford, Manchester United. Because Huddersfield were in the Premier League, obviously. And then I think it was Sharon. I think I bumped into Sharon, and she said, do you want to, you know, do a little bit for us here and there? And it was a no-brainer, because I wasn't doing coaching. I wasn't involved in local football anymore. I was paying to go and watch City.
So you'd gone from Old Trafford to South Shields.
So I am not joking. I went from Old Trafford to where was it? Was it Blythe or Spennymoor? Within a week, Old Trafford to Blythe and Spennymoor. Real life. But good question. But it just happens. Just really lucky because I enjoy it. It's great fun. I get to see City as well. So for nothing.
Perfect. Thanks for your time, Ian.
It's a pleasure.
Ian Dunn, everyone.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go straight on to the next guest then. So, without a doubt, a club legend. Over 300 appearances for York City. I don't know which got a louder response, his goal against Scarborough in 2005 or his last-ditch tackle away at Luton in the playoff semi-final in 2010. Our podcast with him was one of the most honest and compelling interviews we've ever done, so I'm delighted he's agreed to come here tonight. So please welcome David McGurk. Okay, so when I mentioned in the intro there, Dave, about the Scarborough game, it actually feels like yesterday to me. And I wondered, now you've retired from playing, do you look back on your career as something that was over pretty quickly, or do you think it was long when you were playing?
It was definitely long towards the end when I'm injured and in that physio part of cabin with Jeff, you know, that was that dragged out. But it does, like you say, to kids now, and when you were a kid, it flies by. It absolutely flies by. And it's something that, if you could go back, I wish when I was like 18, 19, 20, you'd have put absolutely everything into it, you know, because you look at kids now coming through, they are doing that. And if I'd have done it, or if other players had done it, you'd probably gone to a higher level. But times were different then. You were looking up to your senior like players, and they were going out drinking on a Tuesday, Wednesday. So you start doing that, but things have changed now. It's completely different.
Yeah. And I know it's not exactly Celtic Rangers, but to score at Boven Crescent against Scarborough, I imagine that must be up there with one of your career highlights.
Yeah, definitely. Darren Dunnan took it a little bit away from me because he went off celebrating himself because he whipped the free kick and he said I didn't touch it. But I had it on the tannoy after that, and then it was like, yeah, that's my goal. And you do look back, and even now I show my kids, because my kids are at an age where it was like, did you really play football? And we're not in an age now where you can just automatically click on... they're at an age where you can just automatically click and see things. You've got to go back at YouTube and it's just one clip of it, you know. So it is nice to go back and watch things like that.
Yeah, we said about that goal you got against Forest Green as well, that the pitch, looking back at that, it was like sand everywhere, wasn't it? And I mean, it's just completely different to today, isn't it? It probably wouldn't have been played.
Yeah, well, Ian said about the pitch yesterday being shocking, but that was something that we played on every single week at Bootham, knowing we were going into it where all four corners were like 6 inches deep. You know, your foot went in there, and that the team we had that year was your people like your Clayton Donaldson, Jandy Bishops, Mark Convery's, Brian Stewart, all good players who could run out wide. But that pitch, like, you'd probably cordon it off because it was that bad. You couldn't actually play in it whatsoever.
Yeah.
I think it was Aaron McLean, the biggest Greys in the FA Cup, and he did the hop, skip and jump in it, didn't he? Because it was that much sand that they had put down just to be able to play on it.
Yeah, and those games were under Billy McEwen. I don't think you get too many managers like him anymore. What, give us an insight into what it was like working with him.
Billy, rest in peace, Billy. He was brutal, absolutely brutal. So even young players knew in and you knew your place. And I don't think Billy would work in the modern game. You know, there was no arm around the shoulder or anything like that. It was really, you do it this way or you're not playing. A story, like, there was one lad went to switch the ball in training and he hit Billy in the back of the head when he went to do it. And Billy just sent him in. He was like, don't come back out until you can switch the ball properly. And that's how, he was 19-year-old, the kid, but that's how brutal he was with it, you know. But he developed players, and he always told stories about, like, Malcolm Christie at Derby, Chris Riggott at Derby. He went on an awful lot about Derby, to be honest. But you've seen it with us. Like, you've seen it when players bought into what he wanted to do. He helped me massively. Clayton Donaldson wouldn't have had the career, I don't think, without him. But then... He could clash with people as well, and strong personalities like Andy Bishop, he really did clash with Neil Bishop at one point. And then when Billy started signing the older players, like your Stuart Elliott and your Paul Brayson's, they'd been there and done it. These weren't young kids that we could mould. They were people who would fight back, and probably lost a little bit of respect in the dressing room because of that, you know. And it went downhill from there. But like I said, he had an eye for talent. Martin Wolford's another one. He's brought in a lot of people throughout his career.
Yeah, and in Billy's time as well, the Morecambe semi-final second leg, I was watching that back the other day, absolute GBH, wasn't it, on Clayton in that, yeah, that second leg. I don't know how, still watching it back, like, how he didn't get sent off, and that made a massive difference to the outcome of that game, didn't it?
Yeah, I think I said it on with the podcast, I was convinced we'd win that game because we were keeping so many clean sheets, and then when we got the penalty, you just thought, we're going to go on and win this. But looking back, yeah, he should have been sent off. I think any other game, he does get sent off for that one, for the goal scoring opportunity, and two, for like the level of the tackle that was on him.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just that for us. Clayton fractured 3 ribs there as well, so our best player all of a sudden couldn't play. Well, he did play, but he wasn't effective at all because he was in that much pain. So it was a huge loss, like, from the injury point of view and his playing performance as well.
Yeah, and I think you played your best football, for me, under Martin Foyle. How did he turn round that situation? Because the team he kind of took over from was pretty poor at the time, and probably on the verge of getting relegated, really.
Yeah, Foyle was quite boring in a way. It was like two banks of form. We're going to get the ball into our front two players as much as possible. And when it was Brodie and Ranks, the teams couldn't deal with him, so we always ended up going in the lead with games. And then we just sat in as a back four and a midfield four in front, who understood what we were doing. And we worked on that an awful lot. So any time we did go 1-0 up, we were pretty confident of holding on to that lead. I don't think you underestimate how quick and strong Brodie and Ranks were. They were levels above, not technically great, but as soon as we got the ball into them, they caused problems for like any defenders. For us, I always had lads around me who understood the game well. You had like Mez on one side, and then you had like Luke Graham or Dan Parslow. And we weren't the most aggressive defenders, but we could sit in, understood the game well, and just held out leads.
Yeah. What one game we did take the lead in but didn't manage to hold on to it was Stoke away in the FA Cup. Wonder what your memories of that was, and Rory Delap.
Yeah, it was just a long throw. Did us twice. Again, I'm sure the kids this one was like, can you believe this throw-in? Because it was something that we'd never experienced. And we worked on it in training, but we worked on it with Andy Porter, the assistant manager, throwing it overarm. And even I was marking, I think it was Ricardo Fuller I was marking, but the ball was there. Normally you'd go and attack the ball, but the flight was completely different to anything you've experienced, you know, so you think I'm attacking it and all of a sudden it's gone over your head. We just couldn't deal with it. It was as simple as that, you know. I think Paz scored the on goal, the first one, and then second one bobbled around and they scored again. But it would have been interesting if we'd just held on to that lead a little bit longer. We knew what was coming, but we simply just couldn't stop that.
Or if you'd have had a warm-up. I mean, you guys got me about 5-3, didn't you?
Yeah, but I think, again, I don't know if people listen to the podcast, but I didn't mind that at all, because biggest reason I got into football was because of fans, and I never come out of a tunnel and there's 5,000 fans behind a goal. That was what we were experiencing, you know. We came out, I think we were the last ones there. So for us to come out for just 10-15 minutes warm up and everyone's there, you know, I loved that. And I was one of them, I could just went out without a warm up, I wasn't bothered, but it did get into players' heads a little bit. And we were literally being given our kit on the bus as we were on our way there. And then when we got in there, is it Clem off one of the radio stations?
Oh, yeah, he's
he's in the dressing room, like, trying to interview players. It's like, we've got 2 minutes to get ready here, you know. And I'll get my shin pads on. He was like, what do you think of this, Dave? And it was like, just let me get my shin pads on, you know. But I wasn't bothered about it.
Because some footballers are really superstitious, aren't they? And very precise about routines and stuff like that, aren't they? Did you play with many players that... I think Mark Convery was quite obsessive, wasn't he?
So Mark Convery's got... So, I knew Mark from Darlington, and he's got it's some sort of disease. I can't remember the name for it, but it's some sort of disease where everything's got to be in place, like really, like badly. If he's driving in his car, the air condition's got to be on a certain level. And I think he overturned his BMW because he didn't have the aircon on at one point. But he, all of his bottles and all of his any equipment he had, that the signs had to be faced in a certain way in the dressing room, you know. But once the lads got onto it, you know, as soon as he left it, it just got flung everywhere, you know. So his water bottle, if you can imagine, got like Harrogate Spy, had to face that certain direction. He'd go to the toilet, the lads would just twist it around, he'd come back. He's like, what's going on? But the lads were like straight onto him, and whether it affected him, I don't know.
Probably did if he had a disease, Dev.
I don't know what the name for it is, but he... OCD, yeah. When he first started playing, when the game kicked off, he had to be facing a certain way, which wasn't towards the opposition goal. So if you're looking at him during kickoffs, he was always facing back towards the goalkeeper.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think Richard Brodie mentioned it on Under the Cosh, I think, and said that he went 30 times around the roundabout once just because
I was in his car school, but we got told the story that he could only have the air conditioner on at certain times of the day and it had to be at a certain level, and he ended up crashing his car because he was looking through a little light.
I mean, Luton playoff games, let's come on to us. Are they like other games? I know like a Premier League player will play in front of big crowds every week, but for a lower league player, that's not the case, is it? And I think when you first came under Chris Brass, we were getting crowds of like 1,700. And then Luton, obviously, it's absolutely packed out at Boothen Crescent. Does it make a difference to you as a player? Are you more nervous coming out? Are you more aware of the crowds being in?
Yeah, I was definitely more nervous, but I felt I played my best football when I was a little bit more nervous. So I didn't mind that edge, that little bit more of an edge. And I think all of my best performances probably came when there was a bigger crowd, maybe minus Oxford at Wembley. It was something that I thrived on. I really thrived on it. And when, like, you sometimes go out in front of, I had a Harrogate in the later part of my career, you'd go out and there was 300 fans there, It was like, how do you get yourself up for this, you know?
I think they still get that now.
Yeah. But you're walking out and it's like, it's not the same where you just come out and the adrenaline's going. And I think I listened to a podcast team, Gerard, you go into a zone. It's a zone where you're not even thinking about what you're doing, all everything you've sort of learned, it just comes out in them games.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're very, very humble when we talked about that tackle at Luton, but do you have to sort of trust your gut instinct on that when you're putting that challenge in? Because I was thinking about it the other day, but you miss time back, you're conceding a penalty, you're getting sent off, the team will probably then go on to lose, they don't get to Wembley. But in that moment, are you just literally zoned in on what you've got to do and not thinking about, because if you thought about it too much, you probably wouldn't make the challenge in the first place?
There's no thought behind it. It's literally instinct of, you know, if he's going to take that extra touch, I'm going to have to make the tackle. And once he takes it, right, I'm going for it. But even if he'd have took a good touch across me, I couldn't have made that tackle, you know. So it's not like a step back. I can't explain it, you know. It's just out on there where you know when he takes that touch, you are going to, you're going to make it. If he'd have hit the first time, or if he'd have come across me, then I would have been in trouble. I never at any point thought I would have been sent off. Like, you're not thinking, right, I'm going to be sent off here, you know. You get just instinct and kind of in that zone.
Yeah. I'll leave the audience to ask you more questions about your time at York, but post York City, you played for Harrogate, you mentioned there, and Hyde United. Nearly a decade at York City, 6 goals. Hyde United, 11 games, 3 goals. Four goals.
Well, there was an own goal and I kind of ran off celebrating. They give me it, so I was
like, like Darren Dunning.
You get them, yeah, you get them. The level was completely low, if I'm honest, completely low. It was a point, people were calling me a Rolls Royce in that league, and it was like, I felt like that because it was so low. But my problem was I would play on a Saturday, I couldn't play on the Tuesday, you know, and that's why I was at that level. My body had sort of given up on me a little bit. Yeah, even goal scoring, it was like that. We'd set up set pieces, and I knew I could get on the end of them because, with all respect, like the players weren't bright enough to keep up with the set pieces. Where at the higher level, I couldn't do it. With York, I don't know why it was so low, because I had a decent record, and it kind of become a bit of a stigma for me, you know, going on and on. But 6 goals, yeah, it's pretty crap in that. Only games with 3.
One of them was against Scarborough. That's all right. You managed Hyde United for a couple of years, and around that time, that's when we did our original interview, and you were really passionate about going on to become a top manager, and I think you were linked with York City last season, coming in and being a coach. In fact, I think they announced it and then never said anything again. So I just wondered, what you've taken a bit of a step back from football, what's been the process with all that?
Yeah, so Hyde, we went into COVID, I was enjoying it, but we went into COVID and all of a sudden we had to go on furlough with COVID. My football coaching company was all self-employment, so we weren't getting paid through that, and we had to stop payments with kids. And I started working for my friend's company. It was like a new company called The Modern Milkman, you might have heard of it. He founded it. So when football restarted, I had like a full-time job, I had my coaching company, and I had Hyde. And I said to you earlier, anytime I was in one, I wasn't focusing on it. I was so spread across everything. And then you've got your family as well, young family. And it come to a point where I was like, I can't continue doing all this. So it was, I quit all my jobs on the next day. Because it was affecting, not to the point where I was like mentally depressed or anxious or anything. I could feel it coming on. I think I seen like Jurgen Klopp this week when he said he's running out of energy. That's how I felt. I had no energy to give to any of these jobs anymore. So we'd done pre-season and we'd lost our first 3 games, but I'd actually spoke to my assistant pre-season and said, I think I need to quit because I can't give anything anymore. When you lose your first 3 games, it was like, I should have quit, you know, I can't let this go any longer. So I took, my plan was to take 6 months out of the game completely, which I did, and I said to you, I went on holiday, which was the best holiday I've ever had, because one, I need the break, and two, never had a holiday during the football season since I was 15, you know. And then from that, I've been fortunate in a way where I've made investments over the year where I could take a little bit longer. Carried on with the football coaching business, and then it's only recently, probably in the last 6 months, me and Mikey Morton, who we obviously all know, we're just developing a new business now, which will be released in the next 2-3 months, which is heavily football coaching related. But it's not something that I've had the opportunity to go back into York. Mikey offered me the assistant manager job last year. I went in for 2 days. I actually accepted it. I was in with him. But then the 2 days I went in, I just didn't have that buzz anymore. I was stood there and thinking, I don't want to be here, you know, it's not something I want to do. And I think the next 7 days, it was it was 3 away games, Eastleigh, someone else.
We didn't want to go out of them either.
Exactly. Over 10 days, it worked out, I would have been away for 7 of them.
Right.
And when I'm trying to like spend time with the kids and that, I was like, this is not what I want to do.
Yeah.
I turned it down. I've turned down a couple of other jobs since, but it's not something. A bit disillusioned with it. Football's brilliant and I love it, but the only part I miss is winning. That's all I miss is winning. And I'll go and watch Middlesbrough, and I went to watch Middlesbrough at home, like when they beat Chelsea, and I'd love to be in the staff dressing room now, you know. But then when you go on, I went to second leg when I lost 6-1, it's like, I'm definitely glad I'm not a manager now, you know. That's the kind of way course. It works.
Audience, do you want to ask some questions? We'll again do the same thing. Paul will take the mic round. What's your favourite Charlatan song? I don't know if you've got.
Don't ask me that. No, I don't know.
It's not on back knee.
Yep.
Better.
Hey, Dev. That's better. That's better. I remember when you played Luton and your score on the Evening Press website was the second ever in history, 10 out of 10. It was unbelievable. And then Luton came chasing you. After, I don't know if it was shortly or in that same season, how close were you going to Luton and why didn't you go to Luton?
What happened that season, Mark Beasley, who had been playing at Luton, he came to us at York and he basically told me that they wanted me, and at the time I wasn't interested. But then Foyley left, and it was, again, this is back to the podcast, but on the way on from Newport, we'd lost 4-0. Steve Torby was the temporary manager, and Alex Lawless told me on the bus that he was going to Luton. They'd activated the 50 grand release clause. I didn't have an agent or anything at the time, and Alex Lawless' agent then rang me and said, look, they're willing to pay for you as well. Would you be interested? And I says, well, see if it's got legs, yeah. As it turned out, I spoke to the manager at Luton, I spoke to the chairman at Luton. I know you're not supposed to, but that's the way football works. I don't know what you can say. Like, I was on 500-600 quid a week at York, but they were offering like double, treble that wages, you know. And I said to Nicola, my wife, I think I'm going there tomorrow, you know. But Jason McGill was really angry with Luton. He hated Luton, and yeah, I know. And he put a 75 grand price tag on my head, and Luton ended up matching that. And that was when I said, I think we'll be going in the morning, but I got a train the next day, and Gary Mills says, you're not going. And that was when I stormed. I think we played Southport at home the next day. And I went into Gary Mills' office and I was like, look, you've got to let me go because I'm not going to play again if you don't let me go. And Jason came in and we had it out. And I didn't want to go down that route, but I felt like it was the only way, like, I was going to be able to go. And I know, like, everyone sat in this room was York supporters, but for me it was like a financial and a bigger club move, you know. And do I regret it? Yeah, I probably do in terms of the actions that I took to get what I wanted. But York offered me a new contract. If I didn't do what I did, York wouldn't have offered me a new contract. And the financial stability that York's contract gave was far better than the money that I was on. And I wouldn't have got that without Luton's interest. So... It was a tough one for me, you know. I was in turmoil about it, and Ingy and Chris Smith were really good friends, and we'd go out for something to eat or drink, and they were like, "Don't want you to go," and I was like, "I don't really want to go, but there's no way York can compete with Luton on one a financial or a club level, you know." And I think you've probably seen that where the clubs are now. I know you say that, but he lives in Luton. He's Luton under 23 man, a coach. So it's in. No, but it's like the bigger picture. It worked out for him in a way where he's had a decent career there, you know.
It's a short career as well, isn't it? Like, yeah. Financially, like, if you're, I think any of us in the room, if you were offered 3 times your salary, you'd be probably pretty mad to turn it down. Whoever it is, isn't it?
It was that, and if you looked at it at the time, York were we were selling our best players all of the time, and. I wouldn't say I had an influence on it, but it was only from that point that we started signing. We went out and signed like Michael Gash. We put a bit in for Darius Charles. We started signing the better players within the league rather than selling the better players. So from then on, York became like a bigger and better club, I thought, that looked like they wanted to get promoted rather than losing the better players year on year.
There was another question over here, I think, Paul.
Hi, Dave. Hiya. The Luton playoff semi-final, was that the most intimidating atmosphere you've ever played in? And were you at any point sort of worried when their fans were sort of invading the pitch at the end?
Intimidating, not in the fact before or during, but it was afterwards, where I didn't even realise until probably 2-3 minutes we were in that corner that we were actually surrounded. And then you looked at how thin the steward and police line was. It was like, if they want to attack us, we're screwed, you know. After that, it was like, once we were in with the fans, I wasn't bothered, you know. And then the shepherded us to this little room in the corner, and they were throwing coins, but I've seen the footage, I've got a big coat over me anyway, I was off, like no one's seen me from there. So it was just that, like, probably for 1 second, it was Andy Porter again, the assistant, who come over and went, lads, we could be fighting here, you know. And imagine that, like all the crowd running, our players are just fighting it, and you see it with fans, but we would have had no choice if they'd have wanted to go through that line. But a lot of it was just not intimidation, they were just like threatening without actually wanting to do anything. But if they wanted to, we were stood there. So I'd have probably been the first straight of the crowd, like, yeah, you look all that, or behind someone like Michael Rankin, so I was all right. Yeah, totally. It was before the game was probably the loudest I'd heard in terms of, but I think Brody took a lot of the heat off everyone else, you know. And I think even the pitch invasion was probably caused by Brody, you know. He's, from what I heard, he took his shirt off his head and ran along the whole stand, you know. And that, but even before the game, it was all like, Brody, you're a whatever, you know. And we went kind of scot-free, but I think that made Brody play better as well. He liked all of that, you know. So he took a bit of heat off the rest of us. And even, I think Brody made a run for it, and all the fans just kind of went like that, you know. So if we could have just kept Brody in the corner, we'd have all been all right.
Any other questions? Is it, will you sign my flag?
I was going to save that one for later. I just want to touch on a different era that I don't think we've really, really mentioned yet. So when Nigel Worthington came in, I think a lot of people sometimes forget, but it was almost like you got another lease of life at that point. I think you'd been out of the team for a while with various injuries throughout that season, and then Nigel came in and kind of put a lot of faith in you. And then I think the next season you started most of the games at the start of the season, and then Keith Lowe came in. You built up a pretty good partnership with him. I think that's often forgotten, because in the playoff run, obviously Keith was playing with John McComb. So I was just wondering what it was like for you playing under Nigel and then building that partnership with Keith, because I know a lot of people from the previous squad, for whatever reason, weren't a fan of Nigel, didn't really get on with his playing style, and ended up leaving the club. So what was that kind of like for you?
Yes, and when Nigel came in, I was injured, so I didn't get to work with him at all. But it was funny, I think we'd lost 2 or 3 games, and I'd only trained on the Monday, and then Nicola, my wife, went into labour on the Tuesday. So I was in hospital Tuesday night, Wednesday night, and then Nigel rang me on a Thursday morning saying, you're starting at Torquay on Saturday, can you get yourself down? So I didn't actually go down with the team coach. I went down later on the Friday. So I only played the last 7 games, but it was like desperate times. And, you know, I missed one with, I think Tom Allen played at Northampton in place of me. It was, for me, it was more the understanding I had with Chris Smith at that time. They relied on us, you know, we did well together. And then when we started again the next season, we started really well again. And I think I played the first 23, 24 games, but I must have had about like 5, 6, 7, 8 fitness tests, because my back was, I was really struggling with my back. So when he signed John McComb, I knew that was kind of a replacement for me, you know. For as soon as I come off the team, I wasn't going to get back into it, so I tried my best to try and stay in it, but my back was just giving in. And I played 2-3 games with Popey, and I think we kept 2 clean sheets in them. But again, speaking to the guys earlier, like he was on another level, complete another level. You know, he was coming for, he was coming for throw-ins, long throw-ins before it had even been taken, and he got caught out a couple of times, but he must have, like, I'd say he would take 78% of the crosses that came in. You don't know how many goals that could have caused. But I'd spoken to Nigel the end of January and said I was going to retire at the end of the season, and he says just keep yourself fit and make sure you're ready in case anything happens to them too. Unfortunately, nothing did happen to them too. But even then, like, my training schedule, he managed my training schedule, but I was having injections in my knee and my back, you know, like it got to a ridiculous point, and that's why I had to retire, because for two seasons I'd been having probably three, four injections a month just to get through games, you know, which I regret now because I feel it now, you know, but it was something that, it's your living, do you know what I mean? It's your living. I was only 29, 30, but it was something that I wanted to continue doing and wanted to have an impact. But I could feel my impact was like reducing, and I didn't feel like I was at a League Two level anymore. I knew I had to drop to part-time to have that same sort of impact. And it worked out well. I mean, John Loy, I think the back four and Porby got us to the playoffs at that point, where if I was playing, it wouldn't have been the same because I'd have been in and out the team, you know, and to have someone sat on the bench who was younger than me or not as experienced, it wouldn't have been the same impact. So it was the right time for me.
Yeah. Any other questions? Paul again, yeah. Over there, Paul.
Hi, Dave. You described Rankin and Brodie as handfuls for opposition. When you were during your time at York, who did you least like playing against in terms of opposition strikers?
Steve Morrison at Stevenage was the big one. Caused us all sorts of problems throughout the seasons, and then at Wembley, he was my man on the first corner that scored from in the trophy final. I think he scored. He was my man. So yeah, he was a big handful for me. In terms of that, I think most of the fans know I was kind of more of a sweep-up man. You know, you had your big dominant. My best performance was with people like Jason Goodliff, Janos Kovacs. You know, all these. I was someone who said, "You're going to attack it, I'll sweep up around you." James Dudgeon. There was people like Pars and Chris Smith and Luke Graham were on the same wavelength as me in terms of reading the game. But if anyone went really direct against us, we kind of struggled against it. So yeah, I struggled against your 6'2", 6'3", real dominant centre forwards. Going back quite a distance, Tim Sills, it was Torquay and Aldershot. I struggled against someone like him, where someone more quick and nimble, I felt like they might have had physical qualities over me, but I could read what they were going to do next. So I didn't mind marking them type of players. It was more the ones where, I think there was one game, we give them time on the ball, but they just kept hitting a diag onto me against a big man. And it was like, can we not get pressure on the ball? But we hadn't set up that way. And it was said, you solve it, you know. But I couldn't. I didn't have the physical qualities to actually solve it. Mental qualities I could, but I couldn't deal with it in terms of just competing.
What about teammates?
Best players.
As in, who did you not like playing against in training? Brodie?
No, because I could read Brodie like a book. He was thick, you know. I knew what Brodie was going to do before he did, like, five moves before. You know, he's not that type of player. Someone like Paul Brayson, I mean, he was clever, like really clever, you know, when he come. And then your players, you could see your players who were going to go on further, like your Martin Wolfords and your Clayton Donaldsons, because it come to a point where you knew what they were doing, but they also had the physical quality to go past you. So Clayton was probably the one. Clayton got to a point where, you just thought he's way above this level, you know. And then there was people like Neil Bishop, when you're watching them, you thought they're way above this level. But I wasn't kind of in direct contact with players like that. But yeah, it was usually them, or the real, real quick ones, or the ones who were like physically dominant.
Cheers.
Any other questions? One more? Yeah, Morgan over.
Hi, Dave.
One bit random one. So in 2009, when we played Stevenage at Wembley, obviously we'd worn obviously red home shirt all year. Then we go to Wembley and wear that purple shirt. As a fan, I love that shirt. What were the players' thoughts on wearing this random purple shirt as a one-off occasion? Was it obviously bad luck charm? We lost 2-0 that day. But what did the players think of it? Did you all hate wearing it, or is it not something you'd think about as a player?
We didn't care. I'm colourblind, by the way, so like I'm actually colourblind, so there's some colours. It's the red of York and the green of Forest Green was a nightmare for me, but purple wasn't too bad. We didn't care. It probably, the only thing I'd say, it probably added to the occasion. Like, this is another thing on top of, we went for suit fittings, we stayed in a plush hotel in Watford. It just added to the occasion, because when we went back the year after against Oxford, we did none of that, you know. There was no hotel, there was no change of shirt. It was just like, it was another game, went down in our tracksuits. So yeah, probably added to it, maybe made people a little bit nervous. I couldn't comment for everyone, but for me, it made absolutely no difference at all. And the colours were okay.
Is that the same with every football show? Because I'm interested, because York fans will remember that awful John Batchelor one with the flags and all that. I always think, God, you must look at that and think, what the... You know, but as players, are you just not bothered really? What when a new shirt comes out, is it just right? Well, that's what I'm playing in.
I think so. We normally see it, and the first day we do the photo, like you do a photo shoot, and when the players try it on, they will say they like it or they don't. Even that season, we got the playoff final against Oxford. The red and I like the red and blue, but the collar was terrible, you know. Yeah. And the players will say that, where there was another one with, I think, prize on the front, a white collar you like. So the players see it, and like, there's no comment like, if you look good, play good, feel good. That was Bill McEwen, that look good, play good, feel good, you know. But
that's what they said at Derby.
Yeah, but you wanted to wear something like you actually like. But there wasn't many kits where you'd thought like, I don't like wearing this game to game. So I think it was we had a maroon kit one year. I can't remember which year it was. A maroon one, which was terrible. But yeah, most of the kits I liked.
Yeah, fair enough. Any more questions? Okay, we'll take a break, Bevan. David McGurk, everyone, thank you very much. So we'll have a little interval, and then we'll do the final quiz questions.